mention psychiatry or psychiatrist and my mind immediately goes to a rather diminutive American with big glasses and an obsession with New York, all things Jewish and, of course, sex.
8 years I was on a couch and 5 years I was allowed to sit up and face him and chat and... it helped me, I think. I don't know.
How do you know, really? That's what it's always the big question mark for me is, when do you decide I'm done?
Ah, that's a good point. I don't know if you're ever really done. I know that certain characteristics about me are different now than they were when I started analysis. I started when I was 22 and I'm 35. When I have sexual relations with someone, I can now think of that person.
Rather than
somebody else, which is an enormous step forward to me.
How many years did that take? Where did that come in, roughly?
That just came in last week.
Woody Allen, back in the 70s, on American television. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. Today's show is about the future of psychiatry. But it does occur to me that few of us have any real idea of what psychiatry is all about. Even the difference, say, between a psychiatrist and a psychologist. So let's start there. A psychologist studies behaviour and tries to help patients by talking through their issues, whereas a psychiatrist is a doctor who prescribes medicine to help treat mental disorders. That's the straightforward difference. But then it gets a bit blurred because, you see, psychiatrists are also interested in getting people talking about their problems. And even though they're medically trained and they dispense medication, they've never really, as a profession, been all that interested in the biology of the brain, in neuroscience. And if you think that disinterest in biology seems a little strange, a little unusual, well, so do a lot of practicing psychiatrists, including Dr. Bruce Cuthbert. Professor Cuthbert is with the National Institute of Mental Health in the United States, and he's part of a push to reshape the practice of psychiatry and to move it away from its adherence to what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the manual that's often referred to as the Psychiatrist's Bible. Bruce Cuthbert.
The DSM is primarily intended as a manual for clinicians. But for the past 30 to 40 years, the manual has also served as the diagnostic basis for research into mental disorders. This is a problem because all of the diagnoses are done according to presenting symptoms, what patients say they're having trouble with when they come into the clinic. But we increasingly know a lot about genetics and neural circuits, and we know that the symptoms don't map very well onto those genetics and neural circuits. And so we're finding that for research purposes, the DSM is not serving us very well. As some people have said, the brain has not read the text. And so we really need to try to find alternative ways of conducting research to take advantage of the explosion of knowledge that we're getting about how the brain works.
So in one sense, the DSM is old-fashioned, isn't it? It's looking at the knowledge of the past. What you're trying to do really is to incorporate the new types of technologies and the new types of approaches that have come through neuroscience. Is that correct?
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. We know so much about from neuroimaging, from genetics, and from behavioral science. And one thing to emphasize about what we're trying to do is that this is not just about biology. Patient symptoms are still important. Incorporating what we know about how we have risks for disorders from the environment is important, abuse and trauma. What we're trying to do is just add biology to what we've known already and integrate across all of these ways of looking at the disorders to have a much more inclusive, powerful view.
And do you believe that symptoms observation dominant approach has led to misdiagnosis in the past?
In some cases, but it's also a matter that we now know that our symptoms are syndromes. They're very complex buckets full of different things that go wrong. And any one diagnosis has many different mechanisms. So if you have depression, for instance, you can have anhedonia, which means you fail to find pleasure in your usual things. You may have sleeping problems, social withdrawal. You may feel tense and jittery. All of these different things may have different ways of expressing themselves in the brain or how the brain implements them. And not all people have that same thing wrong with them. So trying to come up with a treatment for depression is very difficult. It's like saying, well, we're going to fix your car without specifying exactly which part of the car you're going to fix.
I've seen it written that your organization's criticism of the DSM represents a landmark moment in modern psychiatry. Do you think that's the case? And if that is the case, why has it taken so long for psychiatry in general to start looking at the DSM and what was needed to update it?
I think it's an evolution in how we think about mental disorders. When the DSM was created in 1980, our current essentially structure of the system, we really didn't know anything about the brain, but it seemed reasonable at that time to assume that different symptoms would relate to the brain. And so there was always a goal of matching up the symptoms to the brain, but we thought those disorders would be the right way to do it. And now we're realizing that the disorders don't match very well onto the brain circuits, the genetics, and the behavior. So now we have to shift and say we just have to set the DSM aside and conduct research on these neural systems, reward systems, fear systems, memory systems, circadian biological rhythms, and just look at the research that way across lots of people to understand the systems themselves. Then we can go back and start to think about how to put together a more logical and rational diagnostic system for the future.
Bruce Cuthbert sounds like a reasonable person, and I'm sure he is, but his comments don't fully reflect the level of antagonism there is in some quarters towards the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and the approach it represents. Critics say treating people according to their mental health symptoms makes as much sense as a physician prescribing the same medication to everyone with chest pain, regardless of whether that pain is the result of heartburn or the beginnings of a massive coronary. In other words, it makes no sense at all. The symptom doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the specifics of the underlying health problem, and simply results in the creation of very broad, non-specific labels like depression and ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Crucially, Professor Cuthbert's organisation, the US National Institute of Mental Health, last year publicly announced that it was no longer prepared to provide funding for research based solely on the DSM's symptom-focused approach. Now, the Institute isn't arguing for the complete scrapping of the DSM, but there are those who are. Dr. Gary Greenberg is the author of several books on psychiatric practice, including The Book of Woe, The Making of the DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry.
There are many practitioners, including psychiatrists, who wonder about the sanity and the soundness of the enterprise in general. So psychiatrists and other mental health professionals view the DSM largely as a necessary evil, or sometimes even as an embarrassment. Now, there's a relatively small number of practitioners and researchers who rely on it to do their work, to organize their research. You need to have a consistent definition of a particular mental illness in order to research a particular mental illness. So the DSM is useful to a small, relatively small group of primarily research-oriented practitioners who can use it to make sure that if I do research in schizophrenia in 2014, I'm researching the same problem as the person who researched it in, say, 1980.
But that then carries with it, doesn't it, a problem that you may well be putting your research focus in the wrong area simply to meet the criteria expressed by the DSM.
Absolutely. The problem here is the problem of the map and the terrain. The DSM is a map. The question is it mapping anything real? Or are the people who are using it engaging in a kind of self-contained exercise, not unlike, to be a little bit provocative about it, not unlike going down the rabbit hole with Alice and into an alternate reality? So yes, you run a great risk of creating a reality that doesn't really jibe with what's actually going on.
So if you are interested in mental illness and trying to overcome mental illness, this is not just a conversation, it's not just an argument about whether the DSM is the best guide to help you deal with that. It's whether it's actually relevant or not, and it's whether it's actually holding back the profession, holding back knowledge that could be useful. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, you know, the problem you're getting at is the problem of epistemology. How do we know anything that we know? And when you have a faulty conceptual foundation, then it stands to reason that everything that comes out of it will bear that fault. Now, that doesn't mean you should throw the whole thing away, although sometimes I think I and other people believe that they should. But it does mean that you have to be very cautious about the kinds of claims you can make. And the problem with the DSM is that nobody, even its most ardent defenders, will tell you that it's anything like a perfect document, or that the mental illnesses that it lists are valid, that they necessarily exist in nature in the same way that cancer or diabetes do. But the problem there is that the same people are in charge of really important institutions in the U.S. and around the world that determine who gets treatment and who gets special services in schools and who gets special treatment in the courts, and all sorts of really important policy decisions and distributions of funds are made based on the DSM. So there's a disconnect between the extent to which the DSM truly represents the reality of mental suffering on the one hand and the power that it has on the other.
Now, as you make clear, I mean, you argue that many of the disorders featured in the manual don't actually exist or are questionable. How is it decided what conditions should be in the manual?
By committee, by vote. It's a democratic process, at least in the democracy of the scientists. And there is no final arbiter except the very smart and very committed people who spend their time discussing, arguing, and researching these things. But it's a self-contained system. There's no external referent to ground it to. So if I argue, you know, there's such a thing as major depressive disorder, I can't find it in a laboratory. So I can't say I know when I have found it. And I can't say that it exists at all. And that's a real problem.
Now, the most recent update to the DSM, the DSM-5, was released just last year. Its publishers, as I understand, claim that it's based on sound scientific data and derived from a comprehensive review of scientific advances. Are they fooling themselves? Is it much of an advance on the DSM-4?
It's a very difficult question. Without wanting to impugn the integrity of the people who make that claim, it is a circumscribed claim about science, especially medical science. It may be wrong for us lay people to expect that scientists really know what they're talking about, that they can point to the data. But I think we do expect that, and there are many fields in which they can. In psychiatry, the problem is that there is no external referent. No psychiatrist will tell you that they think that the disorders listed in the DSM are valid. They will not claim that because they know it's not true. Now, if you accept that you can create a document full of disorders that are just sort of convenient labels, and you define them well enough, you can do science with that. There's no question about it. You can do rigorous inquiry using statistics. But that doesn't necessarily mean that at the end of the day, you've proved anything. You may have simply made an argument about something that doesn't exist. So the problem isn't that they're sloppy or that it's unscientific in that sense. The problem is that it isn't what we expect science to do, which is to expose, reveal, and understand the bedrock reality of the world in which we live.
Homosexuality was probably the most controversial disorder listed in the DSM, and it was removed from the DSM Mark III when it was published in 1980. Do you think there is a disorder, or are you concerned there may be disorders in the manual at the moment that in the future we will look back on them and not only think that they were wrong, but also look back with incredulous disbelief that they were put in the first place, in the same way that we now look back at homosexuality?
Well, homosexuality, of course, is a special case in the sense that the disorder pathologized what we now think of as a political problem. It turned it into a medical problem. So I don't know that there are too many of those. There are a few of them still in the DSM that may in subsequent years look like they were just an attempt to diagnose dissent. But the larger question, whether or not we're going to look back in 50 or 100 years and say, oh my God, what were those people thinking? I think they're going to think that about every disorder in the DSM, frankly.
For over 100 years, Britain's mentally ill were hidden from society in vast Victorian asylums.
The reason why the current debate about the future of psychiatry is important is that for all the good the profession has done over the years, it's also been responsible for incredible harm.
In the last decades of the asylums, psychiatrists tried to cure as well as care for patients. Some of their attempts were barbaric.
It was a disaster. They made a hole in the skull, it went into the brain, and it waggled it a bit, and that was it.
And it's a desire to be more specific about the cause of mental problems and avoid those mistreatments of the past that's driving this push against the DSM, which, by the way, is published by the American Psychiatric Association. As we've heard, the argument is that if psychiatry is to be more than what Gary Greenberg called a system of convenient labels, then it needs to be wedded to advances in our understanding of biology, of genetics and neural circuits. And that understanding has increased dramatically with new technologies. At Stanford University, Assistant Professor Amit Etkin has been at the forefront of using what's called functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, in order to measure the activity of the brain.
The way that these functional MRI scans or functional imaging scans work is that you have somebody sitting inside a big MRI scanner, the kind that you would get a medical test to look at some other part of your body. They lie in there and they do a task. And while they're doing the task, their brain activates and engages in these different things, whether it's emotion or thinking tasks, feeling tasks, and so forth. And what the MRI machine does is it takes pictures of their brain every 2 seconds or so, and you, from that, you can see what brain activity did at different points, and then understand how one region turned on when you did this thing, another region turned on when you did another thing, and understand then how the brain communicates, how it encodes information, how you regulate emotion, how you engage in thinking tasks, and so forth.
And why do you believe, or why should we assume that this is useful in terms of helping with the treatment of mental illness?
Anytime when you think about somebody who has a mental illness, you have to think about what is it that we're trying to do? What organ are we trying to affect when we talk with them, when we give them medications? And fundamentally, that organ is the brain. Because the organ underlying psychiatric disorders is the brain, our ability to image it, see it in action, take pictures of it as it does things appropriately or inappropriately is then what's critical to understanding what has gone wrong in somebody with a psychiatric disorder. By extension, if you want to understand treatment, you want to understand how something you did that didn't directly affect their brain, that is, you didn't go in there and change brain activity directly, nonetheless translated into changes in their brain and therefore changes in their thinking and their feeling, such that they now experience, hopefully, fewer symptoms. So ultimately, the brain is the common organ underlying our diagnosis and our treatment. And any ability we're going to have for any new treatments are going to have to come out of neuroscience.
At the moment, the diagnosis of mental illness and its treatment is based almost entirely on clinicians' observations and talking to patients, getting their responses to questions. Why has it taken psychiatry so long to start looking at the mechanics of the body, if you like, and to start using equipment like the functional MRI scan?
That's a complicated question, and I think you have to look at that in context as well. If you look at other areas of medicine, for example, in cancer, where it's been very well understood for a long time what the nature of the cancer is, it's a particular tissue or cell in a particular part of the body, even knowing that and knowing the kinds of tools you need to leverage to understand that, it's been very hard to really make fundamental progress until relatively recently. So when people think about cancer, decades ago, we've known where we need to look and to some degree how we need to look, but really only very recently has that translated into new diagnostics and new treatments. And that's, in my mind, a best case scenario where the organ is accessible, you can get samples, and you know exactly what you're going after. In the brain, we have a bigger problem. The brain is a very complicated organ. It's made up of many, many cells, all connected in very complicated ways. So understanding even basic things, how we think and how we feel, has been challenging. And then understanding how those things go wrong has been then even more challenging. So that's one answer. But the other answer has to do with the history of psychiatry. Over the course of the last 100 years in which psychiatry has matured as a clinical discipline, we've gone back and forth between different kinds of ways of thinking about psychiatric disorders. Some ways of thinking have actually explicitly said that the brain itself is not that important. That is, that you can look at people's behavior, that you can look at people's thinking, the contents of their thoughts, how they have those thoughts, and get a lot of information out. And maybe the brain's really not a big factor in understanding the disorder. We've let that run through. Clearly, we are no further along now than we were several decades ago. We don't have any new treatments that dramatically decrease the morbidity and mortality associated with psychiatric disorders. Medications have not been created for any new targets in the past several decades. And in fact, those that we have created have really all only been discovered by chance. That is, serendipity revealed itself and somebody said, well, you know, I think maybe this is useful for depression or schizophrenia. And so it's been a gradual process of realizing that there has to be another way apart from just talking to people and seeing something that's one side of their disorder, that is what they tell you rather than what's going on under the hood. So it's been a process of letting that develop, seeing what will come of it, and then trying now to think of different approaches to try to solve the problem.
And as we know, that other way in psychiatry is to have much more emphasis on the possible biological underpinnings of psychiatric problems. As was mentioned earlier in this program, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the psychiatric guidebook for practitioners across the world, was republished last year in its fifth version, the first update in 20 years. So I wonder, what does Professor Ekin make of this new revision?
In my mind, DSM-5 is really not much different than DSM-4. In practice, very few things have changed in the DSM. But it's also acknowledging that there's one way of doing things that has been based on the kind of symptoms people tell you about and the diagnoses you make by clinical observation that probably has a limit at some point. It's probably not of no use, but it's probably not the ultimate answer. So the way I see DSM-5 and 6 and whatever comes later going is iteratively to bring in the neuroscience and change the diagnostic system in as much as we're going to have evidence to support that change. So let me just explain what that means. We know for a fact that psychiatric disorders rarely ever look as distinct in the brain as they look in symptoms or in chapters of the DSM. So we know that a lot of things are going to have to change with the very way we conceptualize psychiatric disorders to begin with, and that the current DSM is going to end up being very incorrect when it comes to explaining the brain. But we have to start somewhere, and that somewhere right now is represented by the DSM. It's also represented by how we do neuroscience experiments in people. We assess particular brain systems for emotion regulation, for reward, for fear, and so forth. And then over time, these two streams are going to come together. Different funders and different organizations may push one stream or another, but in the end, as a whole, as a field, I think we'll see some coming together of a symptom-based clinical diagnosis approach and a brain-based diagnosis of your capacities for particular mental functions.
Amit Ekin from the Stanford University School of Medicine. So the DSM, according to Ekin, needs to change even further if it's to be of any real medical use in the future. But can it change? Well, it seems those in charge of producing the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual are keen to get the message out that they're responsive to the growing criticism, the criticism that's being levelled against psychiatry's traditional symptoms-based diagnostic approach. Psychiatric professor David Kupfer chaired the revision task force responsible for drawing up the DSM Mark V. The word he uses for this new version of the psychiatric manual is iterative. He says it will be modified in future on a much more frequent basis.
We've talked about this as a living document, but it's living in the sense that we believe that we would change parts of it where there is new science and new clinical evidence to change it. So what we want to do is, and this is the reason we are calling it DSM-5, in a way it's DSM-5.0, is to set up a process by which perhaps every 5 years we might make appropriate changes to improve the criteria so that diagnoses might be more easily made. This is also an opportunity for us to include any of the neuroscience findings that reach a level of, if you will, reliability and replication that they can help clinicians to make a more appropriate diagnosis. So we don't see that we would change everything in the DSM every 5 years, but given the fact that we can do this electronically as well as in a written form, it seems much easier than it would have been perhaps in the past before we had really the ability to make these changes.
But you see, do you, a greater willingness to incorporate some of the changes that are going on within neuroscience, some of the advances that are going on within neuroscience, within the biological approach to looking at the brain and mental disorders, do you?
Well, yes, I do. Many of us were, in a sense, picked, and I certainly was involved in picking many people who are both clinicians and also, if you will, neuroscientists. We were hoping that we would have more neuroscience and biological criteria ready for prime time. So we're still hoping that's the case. And in fact, the reorganization of the chapters, when one looks at it, you will see that they do represent a sequence that does represent what we've learned in the last two decades about how the brain functions and in terms of genes and environment. And so they're positioned by broad categories that in a way indicate common features across large disorder groups where we're learning about genetics, cognitive psychology, and neuroimaging, which may make it possible to give us more precise criteria. An example being we see common genetic features in psychosis, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorders. Those chapters are next to each other now in the DSM. But we would like to see more precise criteria based on neuroscience for those specific disorders. And in fact, it may be that the criteria really need to be radically changed. So what we've done is, I would say we've prepared DSM-5 in a much more flexible framework than was available previously. And even in the 1 year since the DSM-5 has been published, there have been a number of scientific advances in autism and some of the other major disorders, which I think are signals to us that in a few years, as these advances get really tested clinically, we will be able to make that first iteration of DSM-5.1 something that incorporates more neuroscience than what we have now. We already have examples in what we call the neurocognitive disorders, Alzheimer's disease, and at least two of the major sleep disorders, where the advances of neuroscience are embedded already in the criteria that we have in DSM-5. So we've broken the ice, in a sense, and I see that what we will be able to do now is gradually fill up that space. But we have to keep in mind that the new advances have to be translated in such a way that we as clinicians can use them.
Professor David Kupfer from the University of Pittsburgh. And you can listen again to our look at the future of psychiatry by going to the Future Tense website. Also featured in today's program were Gary Greenberg, Amit Etkin, and Bruce Cuthbert. My co-producer for today's show was Jennifer Leek. The sound engineer was Peter McMurray. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers and goodbye.
G'day, beloved listeners. Issue 5 of White Paper is out now, and in this issue, RN's journos explore war and conflict around the world and across time. Guest writer John Bale, a fourth-generation soldier, draws on personal experience to examine Australia's relationship with its veterans. So follow the White Paper link on RN's homepage to download now for your iPad.